Hati Mutisya with North Carolina Reading Service, and this is Teen Magazine. For the next half hour, I'll be reading to you from Teen Vogue and Teen Inc. Today's first article is titled, Black Panther Fred Hampton Created a Rainbow Coalition to Support Poor Americans. This article is from Teen Vogue's OG History series, and this is by Tana Geneva, and was published July 25th, 2019. On December 3rd, 1969, 21-year-old Fred Hampton, the chairman of the Illinois chapter of the Black Panthers, led a political education class, had some dinner, and talked to his mom on the phone. He passed out around midnight, still on the phone with her. At about 4:45 a.m., the Cook County Police Department burst into the Panthers' headquarters. They shot 18-year-old Mark Clark, who was on security detail, in the chest, killing him instantly. They sprayed close to 100 rounds as they swept through the apartment, heading for Hampton's room, where he was asleep with his pregnant fiancée. His fiancée and another man heard the gunshots and tried to wake Hampton up, but they couldn't. The police charged into Hampton's room, dragging his fiancée and the other man out. "He's still alive," they overheard an officer say. They said they heard two shots, and a second officer said, "He's good and dead now." They'd shot Hampton point blank in the head. Years later, it was revealed that Hampton's bodyguard, William O'Neill, secretly worked for the FBI. He'd been coerced into becoming an informant in exchange for getting criminal charges dropped. O'Neill had given the cops a map of the apartment that helped them locate Hampton in the pre-dawn raid. It's long been suspected, but not confirmed, that O'Neill had also drugged Hampton ahead of the raid. Years later, O'Neill killed himself. Hampton's killing was part of the FBI's secret COINTELPRO program. COINTELPRO targeted members of the Black Panther Party and other leftist groups in the 1960s and early 1970s, surveilling and infiltrating them to sow discord. COINTELPRO was designed to destroy Black liberation organizations, starting with Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. and Malcolm X, Flint Taylor, the civil rights lawyer who fought in court to expose the facts about Hampton's killing and the existence of COINTELPRO, told Teen Vogue. FBI head J. Edgar Hoover, who started the program, worried that a Black Messiah would electrify the movement for Black rights. In Chicago, at the age of just 21, the charismatic Hampton had realized Hoover's fear, started a number of popular programs, including a free breakfast program. He also founded the Rainbow Coalition, an alliance of uniting poor Blacks, poor whites, and Latinos. The Panthers organized with the Young Lords Organization, a Puerto Rican group, and the Young Patriots Organization, or YPO, comprised of poor white migrants from Appalachia. Hampton and other Panthers, like section leader Bobby Lee, had the case that, as poor white people trying to survive in Mayor Richard J. Daley's racially segregated city, they had more in common with each other than not. They banded together to protect members of the cops, fight against police brutality, run health care clinics, feed the homeless and poor kids, and connect people with legal help if they were dealing with abusive landlords or police. "We did security for the Panthers along with other Panthers," 70-year-old Hi Thurman, a member of the YPO, told Teen Vogue from his home in Alabama. "Here's a bunch of hillbillies doing, you know, security for Black people and Panthers," Thurman said. "That was shocking for a lot of people. Out of respect for the Panthers, the Young Patriots, which grew out of a street gang called the Peacemakers, decided to stop wearing the Confederate flag. Meanwhile, the young lords foregrounded issues impacting immigrants from Latin America and citizens who moved from Puerto Rico, birthplace of co-founder José Chacha Jiménez. They introduced the slogan, Tengo Puerto Rico en mi corazón, in the fight for Puerto Rican self-determination. By organizing them under that banner, it makes it easy for them to come and recognize the class struggle, Jiménez told Teen Vogue. Jiménez, whose dad had worked as an internant tomato picker, said his group had plenty of common ground with the Young Patriots organization. We were peasants. Our parents were peasants. And now we were in the urban city, so it was easy for us to get together. Hampton's death sent shockwaves through the Rainbow Coalition. Billy Shea Brooks, Deputy Minister of Education for the Chicago office of the Black Panther Party, learned of Hampton's murder while he was in jail. I had the pleasure of getting told by this cat. He was the warden in the Cook County Jail, he told Teen Vogue. He came up gloating. They had me in the hole. He came up and said, they killed your punk leader. Jiménez sat near the front of at the funeral service. When the Reverend Jesse Jackson addressed the crowd, he finally realized the full force of what had happened. That's when it hit me that he was dead, Jiménez said. I knew he was dead, but it takes people different words to really hit home. That's when it hit home. I was at the front, trying to hold back tears, and I just couldn't in the end. He recalled thinking, what were we doing that's bad, that they're coming to kill us? The Chicago Panthers' interracial outreach is immortalized in a grainy black-and-white film clip. Bobby Lee, a skinny young black man sporting a black beret and turtleneck, made his case for an interracial alliance at a meeting organized by the Young Patriots organization. A member of the YPO introduces him in a twangy southern accent. I want to introduce a man that come over here tonight from another part of town, but he's fighting for some of the same causes we're fighting for. So I'm going to introduce you to Bobby Lee here, he says. Lee takes over. I'm a Black Panther. I'm a section leader for the Black Panthers. The Panthers are here, he tells the assembled group. You have to tell us what we can do together. We come here with our hearts open. You cats supervise us. We're where we can be of help to you. He runs through all the problems they share. There's police brutality up here. There's rats and roaches. There's poverty up here. That's the first thing we can unite on. That's the common thing we have, man. Lee appears to have won the crowd over. At one point, the video cuts to an older southern white guy who pledges his support to the Panthers. I want you people to stick together, and I'll stick by the Black Panthers if they'll stick with me, and I know they will. Thurman, the YPO member, was at that 1968 meeting. He often worked with Lee. Working with Bobby Lee was great, Thurman said. He always had a great way of educating you. Thurman grew up in Dayton, Tennessee, a town best known as the staging grounds for the Scopes Monkey Trial, a high-profile legal battle over teaching evolution in public schools. It was rough, he said. It was poverty. It was real bad. He estimates he started working in the fields at around age 3, and his family, headed by a single mom, was so poor they had to give away a sister with special needs. Poverty destroys families, Thurman said. He said local cops deemed them poor white trash and hassled him and his siblings. When Thurman was 17, he followed his older brother up to Chicago, hoping for better job opportunities, part of the historic wave of migration from the South to the urban centers of the North. Instead, he was greeted by more hardship and more police abuse. The city had relatively high rates of poverty and unemployment, and many southern migrants who'd only ever worked in farms or mines didn't have the skills to get jobs in the city. Some of the older people had health problems, like black lung from years in the mines, that kept them jobless and suffering without proper health care. Thurman joined a street gang called the Peacemakers. Eventually, they'd become the Young Patriots Organization and join forces with the Panthers and the Young Lords. Thurman remembers asking Hampton why he was willing to work with the white people from the South. "I asked him, why in the world would you let someone like me work with you? We enslaved you. We oppressed your people." He said, "I put that behind me because the revolution is in front of me, and you can't have that without everybody." "So he saw us as brothers," Thurman said. "We were just a bunch of kids trying to survive," Thurman said. Jimenez, co-founder of the Young Lords, was born in Puerto Rico, the son of a farm worker who shuttled back and forth between Boston and Puerto Rico to recruit more workers. They'd paid for the plane ticket, the bed. "You were basically a slave until you made back the plane ticket," he said. His family moved to Chicago in the 1950s, where his dad worked for Armor Meatpacking in the Union Stockyards and joined a social club mainly organized around drinking. His mom worked with the local Catholic church. His mom hosted catechism at the house, which helped him get in Catholic school. He's proud of the Puerto Rican community his parents helped build from scratch around Lincoln Park, but he recalls how constricted his family's movements were in the city. They couldn't go to certain beaches or walk through parts of town for fear of the cops and gangs. "The original point of the Young Lords gang," he said, "was for protection. He says they never dealt drugs. It was just a form of group survival, a way to navigate a city riven by class and race division." His political evolution stemmed from witnessing Puerto Rican families getting booted from their homes as part of urban renewal projects. "Before I finished the eighth grade, I was moved 9 times by these developers and forced to attend 4 different elementary schools, he said in 1974 when he ran for alderman of the 46th Ward, the Chicago Tribune reported. The daily abuse against his people, as well as the historic events of the era, radicalized him. The community his parents helped build was decimated by gentrification and urban renewal projects. After serving a stint in jail, he decided the Young Lords would become a political group. That's when we started trying to form the Puerto Rican Progressive Movement, he said. The Democratic Convention was at Lincoln Park and Grant Park. All those things, Vietnam, MLK getting killed, that impacted all of us. Just like today, Donald Trump impacts everybody. That got people to want to join a group like that. They accepted women, encouraging them to organize. We trusted the women that we were organizing. We had grown up with them. We all became young lords. We had a rainbow coalition, and the beauty about that is Chairman Hampton recognized the fact that we could not talk about the class struggle without talking about racism, he continued. Billy Shea Brooks' family moved from Mississippi to Chicago when he was about 3. His dad was a Baptist minister. Unlike Jimenez and Thurman, he never joined a gang as a teen. Several gangs tried to recruit him, but he was more scared of his parents. "I'd rather fight the gangs than my parents," he joked to Teen Vogue. He was an athlete, running cross-country and track in high school. He'd planned to be a doctor or a lawyer. It wasn't until the latter part of high school that he got involved in politics. After Martin Luther King Jr. was assassinated in April 1968, Brooks said, he started reading every political text he could get his hands on. "I developed a more conscious understanding of imperialism capitalism, and colonialism, he said. Brooks linked up with Hampton, who he admired for his willingness to lay it on the line, and became education minister for the Black Panther Party in Chicago. We read The Wretched of the Earth by Frantz Fanon. It was all to ideologically develop consciousness of thought so we could parlay that into social practice, he explained. We had to implement our survival programs, like the free breakfast program, the medical center. These programs were designed to raise the consciousness of the people so they could see the contradictions and how unfair the government was and still is, particularly with the Tangerine Man in office, Brooks joked about President Trump. Harassment by police and the city were near constants in our lives. Brooks, who also served as Black Panther co-founder Bobby Seale's bodyguard, was under constant scrutiny by the Chicago Red Square and Gang Intelligence Unit. They kind of saw Hampton as a focal point, a galvanizer, Brooks remembered, because he was a hell of an organizer. His commitment was off the charts. People listened to him. They respected him. And that was perceived as a major threat. Once Hampton was killed, everything fell apart. That's when all hell broke loose, Thurman said. When Hampton was murdered, we were harassed. All three organizations took some major hits. I'd wake up and there'd be all these cops in my apartment, he recalled. He said police and landlords worked to dismantle the Rainbow Coalition's social programs. With the breakfast program, the health clinic, the cops would come in and harass the landlords, and they would evict us. They would take medicine from people, harass people. Eventually, Thurman and other YPO members gravitated back south. For years, Jimenez was hounded by the police and was indicted on charges ranging from mob action to resisting arrest, according to the Chicago Tribune. He went underground until 1972 and ended up spending a year in jail. After that, he ran for alderman, getting almost 40% of the vote. All three men abhor President Donald Trump and continue to fight for a revolutionary agenda. Jimenez says he still considers himself a young lord because the group's mission lives on. For one thing, he can't believe that Puerto Rico remains a U.S. territory. He would call it a colony. We should not be talking about a colony in 2019. We have never forgotten our mission to free Puerto Rico and the people from bondage. Thurman pledges to keep organizing and fighting for a progressive agenda, which for him includes LGBTQ rights. I'm 70, but I'm not going to quit, Thurman said. I'm not going to stop until the Lord stops me. Then I'm going to ask him, how is he going to organize? Same for Brooks, who believes women's access to abortion and trans rights are an essential part of the revolution. The beat goes on, Brooks said. What Fred said, we knew going into it that it was a protracted struggle and that we were making the ultimate sacrifice. Tomorrow seemed impossible, but we're still here. We're still struggling. The consciousness of young people in this country today, I think it's soaring, Brooks said. People are more aware of what needs to be done. A mass movement against oppression, all levels of oppression. All the social justice issues we have to process every day, Brooks said. The implementation of concentration camps on the border to the murder of innocent people across the country. The whole fiasco with Eric Garner, it's messed up. But I'm an optimist. I believe the spirit of the people is stronger. We can't give up. What Fred and the Black Panther Party exemplified was a struggle against injustice. It's a struggle that always needs to go on, Brooks continued. You can murder a revolutionary, but you can't murder a revolution. The next article from Teen Inc. is titled, The Time Capsule. Isabel, are you going to wait all day to dig up your treasure? I sigh. My mother is referring to my time capsule, a series of random objects that I used to love when I started middle school, when I thought that it would be a good idea to bury them in my favorite spot in the garden, in hopes of remembering them on this very day, or at least before they decomposed, and anything useful in what was left of them was absorbed by the roots of plants. Unfortunately, with my mother remembering the exact location of the buried memories, there's not much hope of my 18th birthday being free of embarrassing reminders that I haven't always been as beautiful as I am now. Oh, I almost forgot, I lie, hoping my mother can't see through this whopper as easily as she could tell that I hopped a train to New York City with my friend Lucy instead of sleeping over at her house like I said I was. Together, along with Lucy, who went to New York with me, we walk over to the small, plain mound of dirt that signifies all that remains of my 6 years ago self is buried just a few feet below. My mother hands me an old shovel that looks like something a gravedigger would use, and I begin to toss up the piles of dirt that hold 12-year-old Isabel down. Mom, I fib again, since I seem to suddenly have gotten good at it, I can't find the time capsule. I think it's decomposed already. With a sudden, strong motion, my mother yanks the shovel from my hand and starts thrusting dirt into a large, mountainous heap. Lucy's mouth falls open. Isabel, my mother whisper screams in a way that lets me know she's angry and even causes Lucy to flinch, just in case she hits me with the shovel. What is your problem with the time capsule? I don't answer, since I think that this is one of those questions that isn't demanding an answer, and because anything I might say will probably be met with a screeching fit from her. The last thing I want is to ruin my first day as an adult. A butterfly out of her chrysalis, stretching her wings for the first time. My mother finally flings the time capsule out of the ground with a swift swing of a shovel, and I open the pink shoebox just to make her happy. Lucy looks down into the box, and I wish she would just go away, but for the sake of being a decent friend, I let her stay with me. Did I know you when this was taken? She sings songs sweetly, holding up a photograph of me with my brown hair in two ugly braids, blue eyes obviously looking away from the camera, and a face full of blemishes. I shake my head. Of course she didn't. That was when I was ugly and everybody hated me. Lucy and I look through the remainder of the mass of seventh grade garbage inside the box. The latest edition of a magazine, a pink headband, a photo of middle school me that makes me cringe, and a stuffed bear. A stuffed bear. No wonder I had no friends in my pre-teenage years. I pretend to admire the painful reminders of who I was years ago, and then put them back and run into the house, leaving Lucy to gaze mulishly at how ugly I used to be. My mother comes inside with the box moments later. Isabel, she calls from the other room, there's one more thing. I resist the urge to groan and walk over to her. She's holding a pink piece of paper. That was folded as much as it physically can be. I grabbed it from her, trying not to look too angry, and I read it. Lucy reads over my shoulder, and this time, I decide not to be so nice. I make a motion for her to back off, and she obeys, skittering away. Dear Isabel, age 18, the note tells me, and I don't even try to stifle the groans that flies out of my lips as soon as I start reading. I hope life is better for you than it is for me. Do you have any friends? A boyfriend? Are people still mean to you because Dad left you and Mom? They say life gets better as you get older, but I don't really believe that. I feel really sorry for you. Life must be so tough. I hope it hasn't become too much torture for you. Love, Isabel, age 12. I want to crumple the dumb letter up and slam dunk it into the trash can, but I somehow can't. Suddenly, after reading my past letter to my future self, I have an urge to help somebody, even if that somebody isn't around anymore. I grab the nearest pen I see, and I tear my room apart for a piece of paper. Finally, I sit down at my desk and begin to write. Dear Isabel, age 12, I begin. First of all, you're going to have the best friend ever. Her name is Lucy, and let's just say that you'll go on some adventures that you could never even imagine now. The next thing I'm going to tell you might sound pretty bad at first, but it's really not so bad as you think. Things will get worse. People will still be mean to you. You'll be the only girl without a date to senior prom, and you won't be accepted to that college that you've always been dying to go to. But the thing is that you'll learn to deal with whatever life throws at you. You know, this might sound like a nightmare to you now, but I promise that you'll be happier than you've ever been in your life in the next few years. Just focus on the good things, and you'll be okay. Love, Isabel, age 18. I carry both letters upstairs and put them in my tiny, empty jewelry chest. I guess that a time capsule is a burden to remind me of the past days. I guess that a time capsule is not a burden to remind me of the days past, but an opportunity for me to help put a broken girl from years ago back together. Well, we've run out of time for today's episode of Teen Magazine. Be sure to listen next time. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Bahati Mutisia, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Teen Magazines is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. That number again is 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.